Uncle Don here with show number 299. This is the Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George with today's Good Cheer. If you missed my book sale at UNBC last Wednesday, you won't have another chance, not with me. Since February of 2000, I've occasionally set up shop in the Agora, flogging discards from the Jeffrey Weller Library. 33 times these sales have distributed surplus books, getting them into the hands of eager students and staff. Those sales netted a total of $9,883.13 for new library acquisitions. I find those sessions take too much out of me, and my hearing loss makes communication with buyers an embarrassment, so I'll now pass the chore to another volunteer. If this appeals to you, visit Heather, the acquisitions librarian on the fourth floor. Running these sales doesn't take great effort. They provide a good way to meet people while helping your university library. The best news of the day, or decade so far, is the exit of George Wanker Bush from the presidency of the United States. Along with editorial cartoonist, I'll miss this guy. He has been such an easy target. Now we'll see whether Obama can make good on his campaign promises. I fear that he'll be spending most of his term just fighting the fires left by his hated predecessor. According to Le Monde, Obama will have his hands full trying to fulfill his pledge to withdraw combat troops from Iraq within 16 months. He has to confront an entrenched militant Pentagon bureaucracy bent upon sabotaging his efforts. Obama says the war distracts from real threats to American society. It affects the U.S.'s actual security, its standing in the world, its military power, and its economy. The Pentagon, in the person of General Petraeus, insists that any withdrawal of soldiers should be conditions-based rather than performed on a timetable. The general well knows that conditional targets, once established, are subject to conditional interpretations. Under his terms, the occupation could go on forever. The good general insists there must be a residual force to maintain security and training, which sounds fine, except this residual force could be as large as the current combat deployment. The New York Times reported that some fighting units in Iraq are already being relabeled as training and anti-terrorism units. Naturally, this remissioning has no effect on the ground. It's similar to changing a company's letterhead and calling it a reorganization. The U.S. was forced to enter into agreement with its puppet Iraqi government last year as its mandate for occupation granted by the U.N. Security Council was due to expire. To have remained without permission as their stooges would have revealed their operation as a naked aggressive war. The Iraqis made some serious demands of the U.S. for acquiescence in their continued occupation. One condition was the U.S. bases may not be used for operations against other nations. Another is that all foreign soldiers, combat, and support must be out of Iraq before 2012. General Petraeus immediately began a unilateral interpretation of the prohibition of attacks on other nations, read Iran and Syria. According to him, it does not include action in self-defense, a concept shown to be very broadly defined by the American government. Ideally, there should be no conflict between Obama and the Pentagon. Under the U.S. Constitution, the president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He is the boss, and he determines policy, period. George Bush's, both of them, were not shy about sending soldiers wherever they pleased without congressional approval or the acquiescence of anyone else. What they ordered happened. Why should Obama bend to the will of generals who serve at his pleasure? Might there be a distribution of actual power not apparent in the written Constitution? Might it be that the military and security apparatus of the U.S. are so powerful in their own right that they can threaten to circumvent the president's orders? Is it possible there's somewhere a contingency plan to declare emergency powers and a coup? The new president could be aware that his functional span of control is limited. We once believed the U.S. stood as a paragon of the rule of law over the rule of men, but George Bush the Lesser put close to that argument. I fear that a military coup in the States is quite possible. The majority of citizens are complacent and would fail to resist if the propaganda mills told them that they and their property were in danger. Fear is a potent force, especially when cleverly used by the powerful against the ignorant. We thought it could not happen in Chile, but they had their own general in the wings. Prince George's notorious substitute for breathing material is about to be cleaned up. Our local air improvement roundtable aims to reduce particulates smaller than 2.5 microns by 40%. This is great news, as these tiny particles are the ones that give our lungs serious grief. But before you put away your gas mask, let's look at the fine print. This 40% reduction is a toothless voluntary target. As the politicians would tell you, it is aspirational, not respirational. If this target is not achieved by 2014, the Ministry of Environment is committed to consider non-voluntary measures. More bullshit presenting a proposal for a future government 5 years hence to consider the problem. Here's a question I've heard a number of times from mystified observers. Why does Premier Gordon Campbell promote the existence and expansion of Atlantic salmon fish farms in areas where their waste and sea lice are killing off wild salmon runs? The science has been done. We're losing our wild salmon. Perhaps we've been looking at this question the wrong way. Try this. Who benefits if our Pacific salmon become extinct? Fishers are an independent lot, not easily controlled. Campbell's liberals would suffer no great loss if they went out of business. On the other hand, fish farms are owned by corporations, corporations that can be counted on for support and contributions to a friendly political party on which they depend. If we had no more wild salmon in our seas and rivers, the Federal Department of Fisheries and Oceans would lose jurisdiction to protect non-existent fish stocks. The province would be free to allow destruction and pollution of streams and rivers bereft of fish. Regulations could be eliminated, and forestry giant, no strangers to Campbell, would save plenty of expensive work. Dead streams would be candidates for so-called green power initiatives, as entire flows could be diverted and more power produced, speeding the displacement of our BC Hydro as a public source of electricity. With no salmon in the oceans, a major impediment would be removed from eventual offshore drilling for oil and gas, a pet project of the Liberals. Slice it this way or that, destruction of salmon runs would be a big plus for Campbell and his friends. It's all just a matter of how you look at the question. There's a major promotion for BC Hydro to buy all of the clean or green power it can. Sounds good, doesn't it? Save the environment, pet a baby seal, save the whales. More bullshit. At first glance, this concept of clean, renewable power from harnessed streams and rivers sounds fine. What damage can it do if a flowing body of water is diverted through a pipe and then returned unchanged to its channel, especially if there are no fish to worry about? Now look at the facts. Most of these streams being staked by independent power producers are in remote areas. To develop generation plants, access roads must be cut, forests felled, and power lines constructed. Previously pristine areas are then open to ATVs, snowmobiles, and hordes of hunters and other intruders. There go vast sections of irreplaceable wilderness. The Liberal government has mandated BC Hydro to buy power from these IPPs on 20-year contracts, after which they will be free to sell that power wherever they please, using public power lines for transmission. By becoming addicted to electricity from these private for-profit outfits, we leave ourselves open to blackmail in two decades as they play our needs against those of a power-hungry nation to our south, which shall not be named. Industrial users of electricity point out that, in the near term, Hydro will pay as much as 3 times more for this private power than it's wholesaling that power for. This expensive stuff will be melded with cheap public power, and everyone gets to pay more. Why doesn't BC Hydro continue what it has successfully done for decades, produce its own electricity and sell it through public distribution lines, giving our citizens some of the least expensive power on the continent? That's an easy one. Campbell has plans to destroy another of our crown jewels to throw profits at his corporate friends. In grade school, I learned a lot about numbers. They fascinated me. Perhaps I learned too much because the ignorance of today, many today, frustrates me. Like rounding numbers, for instance, I hear people say that gasoline is selling at our colluding retailers for 84 cents a liter. The posted price today in Prince George is 84.9 cents. If you want to round that to the nearest cent, do it right and round up, not down. That in that initial terminal 9/10 of a cent was tacked onto prices by John D. Rockefeller when he held a monopoly on gasoline retailing in America. He relied on public ignorance of rounding to scoop millions in unnoticed profits. Similar ignorance is preyed upon by retailers who love to advertise products just a cent or two short of their real effective price. Look at a Sears catalog and check the snowblower on sale for just $5,999.99. The casual observer, not thinking clearly, says, "Oh, just $5,000 for this marvelous machine." Add the taxes and it comes to $6,720 less a penny. But who cares? Few retailers post an honest rounded price. Check Value Village. All of their price tags are pre-printed with a 99-cent addition to the dollars. Then there's the concept of significant figures. If I tell you that I have a gallon of gas, that's an approximate figure. Very approximate if you aren't told whether the gallon in question is Imperial, Canadian, or American, which are all different. When Canada converted sales of petroleum from Canadian gallons to liters, one chain handed out conversion tables telling customers that 1 gallon equaled 4.54609 liters. From a rough single significant figure, it converted to a scientifically exact six-figure amount. If you want to express exactly a gallon in six figures, the correct way to write it is 1.00000. How many going merrily into debt calculate the effects of compound interest? Put it on your credit card, just 2% a month compounded forever if you don't pay off the whole balance immediately. Sure, buy that new television set on credit, take a few years to pay it off, and arithmetic will tell you you've paid for it twice. It's ignorance of basic math coupled with greed that got our whole economy into the terrible fix we're in now. If we don't begin to understand arithmetic and living within our means, we're in for more rounds of the same over and over and over. There's nothing like a crisis or a perceived one to expose the tender underbody of legal protections erected over the centuries. Recent examples are legion. The right of habeas corpus is an integral element of law in progressive democracies, but numerous governments have found a way to circumvent it in supposed emergencies. Under George Bush, habeas corpus became laughable. Using as justification a fanatical attack on some American buildings, he arrogated a royal prerogative to declare anyone, citizen or no, an enemy of the state subject to indefinite incommunicado imprisonment without charge or right of defense. The United Nations failed in its goal of keeping weaker nations safe from aggression of powerful neighbors. This was to be enforced by a Security Council, but necessary compromises gave five of World War II's victors a veto over any action. The General Assembly of all member nations is a toothless debating society whose numerous resolutions are largely ignored. George Bush's, both of them, disregard the United Nations Charter to wage wars on Iraq. George the Lesser attacked Afghanistan in full violation of the Charter. Here in Canada, we have our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, but a compromise added Section 33 to the Charter. This grants federal and provincial legislatures the authority to pass legislation violating Section 2, the one guaranteeing freedoms of conscience, religion, thought, belief, opinion, expression, communication, peaceable assembly, and association. Legislatures with a simple majority vote may also circumvent the entire section on legal rights by invoking this notorious notwithstanding clause. Therefore, most of the freedoms that Canadians expect to enjoy in perpetuity can be abridged by any of one federal or 10 provincial bodies. The ongoing fiasco of the Olympic Village funding has exposed flaws in provincial citizen protections. The City Charter of Vancouver guarantees that the city shall not take on debt except as authorized by a city citizen referendum. Right. When City Council sought to take on unlimited debt without facing its public, they appealed to the provincial legislature to amend the charter. Our legislature has rules requiring that new bills must be subject to three readings and debate. But these rules are also flexible and can be cast aside if the Speaker declares an emergency. In the case of Vancouver's borrowing to finance a fancy Olympic housing project, two protections were cast aside in a single day. Vancouverites lost the right to a referendum, and citizens of the province lost the right to a fair consideration of a serious change to a city charter. As we carry on complacently with our daily lives, politicians at all levels scheme, pursuing their own ends, not necessarily in accord with popular will and laws of the land. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. As we were diverted by minor concerns like wars, financial collapse, Harper's depredations, and the election of Obama, the press passed up a major news story. They've concentrated on George Bush's violations of the U.S. Constitution and international law, while overlooking his wife's having been caught in what observers called an unforgivable major faux pas. In 2006, Laura attended a White House reception wearing a fashionable Oscar de la Renta dress, one identical to those of three other guests. Oh, the shame! What mortification must have been felt by all four victims of this unmitigated disaster. While men mingled in their dark suits as identical as a herd of penguins, their spouses just had to appear unique. That's fashion. But help is on the way for harried women fearful of experiencing similar humiliation. Thanks to the wonders of modern communication, a website has been established at www.dressregistry.com on which guests can reveal to one another what creations they intend to wear to a particular function so that others will not duplicate them. Isn't it nice to know that all the creative effort expended on building the internet hasn't gone to waste? We're in the midst of a period our children and grandchildren will read about someday if civilization survives. It must have been like this in 2009 as markets collapsed, but daily life seemed to go on. Now, as then, people are stunned, hoping that those more powerful and knowledgeable will do the right thing so the brewing storm will not engulf them and their families. For the first 4 years of the Great Depression, the U.S. government was in the hands of conservative thinkers who held that budgets must be balanced, expenses cut, and taxes raised. In hindsight, we know this exacerbated the collapse of trade, jobs, and income. Today's government officials have pledged not to repeat the mistakes of 60 years ago. No, indeed, they will forge a new path, making new mistakes. It's disconcerting that many of those appointed to rescue us from the follies of Wall Street and Pennsylvania Avenue are the same masters of the universe who held positions of power in financial institutions leading the charge into fiscal folly. But events are unfolding too fast for government to serve as a training ground for inexperienced talent, so people with knowledge and, we hope, a capacity to have learned from their errors have been chosen as our saviors. The United States Congress, in its wisdom, dropped a check for $700 billion into the hands of one of these veterans. The authorization was intended to pour liquidity into a frozen credit system, and half has now been allocated. By a twist of definition, a skill common to administrators, some of those billions have been diverted to auto companies for temporary life support. It appears that more billions will be spread far from intended recipients to bail out far-flung supplicants. Las Vegas is hurting. Will government hand tax money to casinos? I read that Larry Flint has petitioned for public aid for his floundering pornography industry. As long as China has a taste for U.S. treasuries, who cares where the money goes? Future generations of Americans will be called upon to redeem the debts their fathers racked up for short-term flotation of an economy that spent and borrowed itself into a pit. Maybe the literalists of biblical interpretation are right, and Armageddon will be upon us any day, then debts to the Chinese will be canceled by divine fiat. If not, future lives of those cursed with having to repay the loans may be, as the man said, nasty, brutish, and short. Here in Canada, Harper follows the American model by offering incentives, breaks, and cash hither and yon. The crisis gives him an opportunity to take care of his friends. How else can we explain that he is cutting income taxes in full knowledge that any beneficial effects will be felt well into the future and much of the money forgiven will not be used, will be used not to stimulate the spending, but to pay down debt or build personal savings? And Gordon Campbell is slashing stumpage fees for trees cut on public lands. Will this help sell our lumber? Will it put loggers back to work? If he wanted to create jobs in British Columbia, he could, with a stroke of a pen, prohibit the export of raw logs to the States, jump-starting some of our idle sawmills. As it is, by reducing stumpage, he will merely be creating work for lawyers hired to fend off American charges of violation of the softwood lumber agreement. This financial crisis has been and will be the cover for many favors being showered on politicians' chosen friends. The end is not in sight. My introduction to the British Columbia correction system was in Victoria when I killed some time as a volunteer probation officer supervising men performing community service. Not much later, I returned to Prince George, low on funds and looking for a steady job. Until then, my working life had been in jobs taken just to fill my time and wallet. Now, at 40, it was time to get serious and find something permanent, ending with a pension to save me from eventual dumpster diving. I looked into work with the provincial government, but most of the openings were for people already in service. I would have to start in a lowly, undesirable job and apply later from within. One place always hiring was the local jail. I applied, had an interview, and was hired as an auxiliary security officer, that is, a swinger of keys called on short notice to fill odd shifts. A few months of this, and I landed a regular position with regular hours. It was a year and a half before I won a better job, but that was long enough for me to learn the justice system's dirty little secret. Listen closely, and I will tell you. Canada's jails hold a vast number of innocent men and women. This isn't just the opinion of a bleeding-heart liberal, but a conclusion I drew from experience in dealing with prisoners and staff. It's the result of serious systemic shortcomings. The first of these is the proliferation of plea bargains, whereby an accused who faces years of imprisonment, if convicted in a trial, is offered a far lighter sentence if he will plead guilty to a lesser charge. This happens all the time. There are many reasons why the person will often take the bait and serve the time offered, whether guilty or innocent. One is the system of legal aid, wherein a lawyer is paid by the state to defend the poor. A legal aid lawyer will be tempted to convince his client to cop a plea and cut short the court process rather than spend the time and effort to go the whole defense route. Legal aid stipends are notoriously poor, and few dedicated lawyers wish to waste their talents in lengthy proceedings for little pay. I can't tell you how many young prisoners told me that a legal aid lawyer promised probation if they would just plead guilty. The next thing they knew, a judge sent them off to the Crossbar Hotel for a year or two. Another factor in promoting plea bargains is that prosecutors keep score. Every plea bargain is a plus score, and the occasional lost court case is a negative. They don't want to risk losing cases, so they offer generous bargains. Many of the accused are indigent. They're not eligible for bail, so they face months locked in remand units if they choose to go to trial. Remand is less fun than sentence time, as remand inmates are kept under tight security and not allowed to work. They sit idle, locked in units with their peers, who may be awaiting trials for anything. Even if they go to trial and are found not guilty, they will still have served time, so a light sentence given swiftly can mean less actual incarceration. Some who might have had some money before conviction spent it on lawyers. Defendants with plenty of money hired slick lawyers who beat their cases, and we never saw them in jail. Rich people do not go to jail except for egregious high-profile crimes. Conrad Black pushed too hard against the system, as did Martha Stewart. Even these people do not get hard time with common folk in lockup. I once heard a judge justify sentencing a white-collar thief to a cushy minimum security institution, as he would have been in danger if mixed with ordinary convicts. I can tell you, everyone outside of solitary confinement is in mortal danger from other prisoners every day. Those scales held high by the blind figure of justice aren't as level as they appear from the ground. One familiar with the system soon learns that that legal has little to do with justice, except in name. Many of the kids, and I mean kids I supervised in jail, were inexperienced and ignorant. Ones just off reserves were the most vulnerable. Going to the big city without skills or education left them drifting around the bars until they got in with hardened types who promised easy money. Or they may have stolen to eat. Either way, they got scooped by the cops and thrown into a system they didn't understand. Conditions are much worse inside than those days when I was a guard. Back then, many of the men serving less than 2 years in Prince George's jail were there serving short sentences for domestic violence, breaches of probation, drunken driving, auto theft, and such, not to mention those innocents caught up in the system's gears. They had an ameliorating effect on the violent minority. According to friends still working in the system, today's convicts are a more hardened crew. We have gang members with crack and crystal meth addicts in the mix, while many of those with the minor offenders have been shuffled off to community service. Both staff and those innocents I talked about are in greater danger than we ever were. If you think I'm a bleeding heart, you don't know my wife. We met in jail, a fact that is a great conversation stopper. She worked there. She knows the system from both sides, as she was arrested one night, hauled off to the cop shop, and treated like crap. She might now be serving time for attempted murder if she had lacked an ironclad alibi supplied by none other than the warden himself. Her former husband chose to set her up at the wrong time, claiming that she shot at him. A planted gun and a bullet in a window casing could have led to her spending serious time as a guest of the Queen. She knows which way the wheels turn and how easily one can be swallowed by an impersonal system. Dick Cheney, until today the vice president and Edgar Bergen for Bush's Charlie McCarthy, has made a spirited defense of torture in the Homeland Security toolbox. Naturally, he could not call that spade a shovel, so he christened the practice robust interrogation. He claims that American lives have been saved through such cute tricks as waterboarding, sleep deprivation, stress positions, and the like. Would it then be inhumane to apply these tactics to the whole Bush crew in interrogations preparatory to their war crimes trials? If Citizen Cheney should not be forthcoming during such an investigation, which we might call an inquisition, what lawyer of his would dare to raise any objection to the loosening of Cheney's tongue through a session or two of waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and stress positions? If tickets to witness the process were to be auctioned to the highest bidders, the U.S. government might be able to raise enough money to pay off the national debt. I won't end a program on this glorious day of George Bush's humiliation on a sour note. I have some good news on the employment front and for those who fight against discrimination in hiring. This last month have seen an influx of 21,000 recruits into the ranks of the American military. This should balance the loss of soldiers, sailors, flyboys, and jarheads due to disgust, desertion, death, and disability. It would certainly be a blow to the empire's policing of the world's peace if they were unable to fill vacant spaces in their military ranks. Since the idea of restoring conscription has been rejected, U.S. forces have relied on a virtual economic draft to suck in the desperate, hoping for three squares and some future benefits. You don't want to force the prosperous into the ranks, as they tend to be disgruntled and cause trouble. Warm bodies are attracted to the Pentagon's workforce, with significant signing bonuses, drawing those who will sell their futures to solve immediate financial problems. Bill collectors could be directing the young and indebted into this one-way ATM machine. But I mentioned discrimination. The forces have again lowered the physical and moral standards required of recruits. HIV/AIDS? No problem. Psychosis? Come on board. A record of criminal violence? We can use your skills in Afghanistan. Watch for recruiting personnel to set up shop at the exits of American jails and hospitals to snare the valuable talents of this pool of potential soldiers. This closes the 299th edition of the Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR in Prince George. Here we go into the new Obama era. Hang on.